Chatanefesh. How's your sister, Vic? Okay. The best under the circumstances. Right. That's the answer. Okay, today is November 5th, 2018. It's a beautiful Monday morning, although they predicted rain. It did rain during the night. If you went to shul when I did early in the morning, it puddles all over the place, but subsequently, but we need the rain, so either way we win. I want to say hello to the wonderful students in front of me and to those listening across the vast universe of Torah Jews. I want to comment. I got an email this morning. I called the person to try to find out. People think I remember every shiur word by word. A lot of happens between shiurim. But I'm maledicted. I called someone a manufalin shiur. Anyone know what they're talking about? The only thing I can figure out, it's Berkowitz. And I was mad at Berkowitz because in public at Avichai, speaking to Anglos, 99% from, he said, I quote, that came back to me from many people, we don't need a new pair of shoes every Shabbos, but we need food. So, lefishitato, all the food stores should be open. So I was a little bit upset, to put it mildly, but if I called him a manuval and repeated it, if that's what he's referring to, I apologize to everyone concerned. I should have called him a pushtak, and no one would have been troubled. I do want to mention, Eti, that I revise what I said yesterday. People ask me what I'm going to do second round. All right, I have a right to my opinion, but I have no opinion right now because I found out that Lieberman, it is true, I didn't believe it. I heard it Friday from one grandson, but other grandchildren confirmed it, and others confirmed it, that it seems a week ago Shabbos in Ashdod or Ashkelon, wherever, there are various versions. He ate chazer on Shabbos in the canyon, or he went shopping in the canyon to show the Russians, vote for my parties, so you'll be able to do anything you want on Shabbos and Yontif and food-wise, etc. And this seems to be absolutely true. It was in the newspapers. My grandson tells me, I only read the Friday papers during the week. I don't have time, but over Shabbos, over the weekend, what's important, I get a chance to look at. So, and he supports Berkowitz. Lyon. He supports Lyon. So I'm going to wait to see is what the Bayit Yehudi decides to do, and my king, Aryeh King. And when I see what they decide, I'll know what I decide. But it's Torah is not the factor here. It's very sad. It's all the other underhand deals that are being made. It's sad, but I guess that's the reality of politics, and that's why people like Rakefet don't succeed in life. He remains behind the desk teaching Torah. So what can you do? It's a different world I'm in. Now, and here I want to say something for the world, because again, I'm frightened stiff as every day moves by. Another acquaintance of mine goes to the better world, and I become maybe the only person who can tell you what I'm about to tell you. I received an inquiry from England, and a number of questions, but one of them, this is from someone who's been a student, a sub-student for many years. As far as you're aware, did the Rav ever meet the Satma Rav or learn Vayakal Moshe? If so, what was his opinion of them? So I wrote back what I wrote back, and you see he answered Sherry thanking her, and he said he was upset by the facts I told him. So let me tell you the story. I don't believe the Rav ever met the Satmar Rav. But what happened, there were two different worlds. The Rav is in America from 1932. By the time the Satmar Rav came to America in 1946, a refugee, 1946 he came, I believe. But by the time the Satmar Rav came, the Rav already was totally Americanized and totally involved in YU. And I don't believe he ever met the Satmar Rav. But what happened was, and it goes back, it has to be 57, 58, you can check it out historically. There were big demonstrations in Israel against the government. Exactly what the reason was, I don't think it was Gius Banot. I think that it could be it was Gius Banot. You got to remember, the Israeli army was formed. They wanted to take yeshiva boys. There were demonstrations then, but that was solved at a relatively early time because for Sacha Kol, there were 300-400 yeshiva boys in Israel. So by the early 50s, Ben-Gurion agreed, don't take the yeshiva boys. Torah is wiped out. Remember, all of Europe was wiped out. In America, if you wanted to look for a real Talmud Chacham, you needed 5,000 candles to find one, if you could find one. So there was a feeling that Torah was going to disappear. No one could dream what would ultimately happen. And today we have Talmidei Chachamim, Baruch Hashem, Malayim Kreisam Basavayayim, to use the rabbinic aphorism. So that was solved. It may be Gius Banot, the drafting of women, which at a very early stage they needed people in the army. The whole country was under 1 million people at the time. So there were big demonstrations. And then in America, the Satmar demonstrated in front of the Israeli consul in New York, Upper East Side. And everyone, front page news, New York Times, Daily News, New York Post, Daily Mirror, these were Daily Terror, there was a Telegraph newspaper in New York, a lot of newspapers then. It's not like today where everyone gets their news online. So after Shir, we asked Rebbe, what do you think of the Satmar demonstrations? And oh boy, the Rav got very uptight. And he said, Bring me a Rambam, Hilchas Tshuva. Remember it like yesterday. And again, the kid shot into the library, brought down a Rambam, Hilchas Tshuva, and the Rav opened up, Nemakuk, take a look, Perikimul Halacha Yud Aleph, Hilchas Tshuva. And he read it like I'm reading it now. Ha-Podesh Midaki Tziba. Afal pi shaloa va veigot el nivnal me adat Yisrael v'yeinu osem mitzvot beklalam v'lo nichnas betzaratam v'lo mitnane betayni tam el holeich ki bedarko ki echad migayay haaretz kilu eino mehem ein lo chelik liolam haba. And he got hysterical. He said, doesn't matter how frum they are. We can be makpid and glat kosher and chol of Yisrael, the loa va'veirot. But if he's not part of Klal Yisrael, demonstrating against the state of Israel, and then the Rav said words that I'll never forget. The Gentiles' hands are still covered with the blood of the 6 million. We're talking, this is the mid-50s. And you're demonstrating against the state of Israel? Ein lo chelik l'olam haba. He closed the Rambam. He walked out very agitated. So that's what I remember clearly. Many years later, I would never dream that I have Talmidim listening to me at this very moment in Satmar. So a group of them, I was in Borough Park. They wanted me to give a shiur. I said, look, if I give a shiur, it'll cause trouble for you, for me. I didn't come to America. I quoted to them, there's a Yiddish aphorism, which can't be equaled in any other language. I can see Jack Mills said, a gast speit nicht auf dem Tisch. A guest doesn't spit on the table. So I said, let it be. You want to hear my shiur, my gift to crowds that are with me. The Satmaruv doesn't have to react, etc., etc. But I became friendly with some of these Satmar. They're quite these, it's a different Satmar today. Rakefet is absolutely right. Our greatest vineyard of future good Jews is Satmar. We have to reach out to them. They have real problems. They have problems in America because it's a third, fourth generation. They're not the Satmar who came from Ungarn, who came from Hungary. These are American kids. Some of them are on drugs, on dope. I don't want to mention what else they're on. It's a three-letter word that begins with S and ends with X. They have problems. They're low pressure. They've opened up. two of the Satmar Einiklach are officers in the IDF as we speak. They're commanding soldiers in the IDF. Halavai, they should remain frum. One I know wears a kippah. The other one I'd never able to figure out from the pictures I see of him whether there's a kippah on his head or not. That's why anyone asks me the size of a kippah, I say that it should be visible when on your head. If people wear these beanies, so wear Pepsi-Cola bottle cup. Minus Shalom, that's not a kippah. So Rav Moshe has a tshuva. He says, say that. We don't have to go into it now, but it's an interesting question. But so I asked them, how can the Rebbe hold this position? It's Porish Min HaTzibur. So he gave me an answer that opened my eyes. He said to me, Rebbe, you versteht nicht den ganzen, you don't understand entirely. To the Satmar Rebbe, their tzibur are their people. Any other Jew who's not like them is not part of the tzibur. You follow? So you can't argue with that. To me, an answer like that is apikoros to the 50th power, not the second power. What do you mean, Narat Tzibur? Look at Chabad. You see, Chabad, I heard a whole discussion this morning on the radio at 6, I was driving here, the davening was about 6:10, so you all know the shluchim are getting together in New York. They just took a picture of a 5,300, I believe, shluchim. They have to take 5 different pictures and join it together. And these Israelis were talking with awe. Israelis, I don't know if they were from or not. Again, today, 10 years ago, anyone on the radio was not from. Today, it's a different story. But they were talking with awe, no matter where you go, there is a Chabadnikim. And they said, do you know that there's a Chabad Shaluach from Route 6? So the girl talking with him says, what are you talking about? And he says, yeah, when you stop for gas, you stop to eat something, there's a tefillin stand, they have a shul too, unbelievable. So you see the difference with Chabad, and you've heard my lectures I gave 2 years on Chabad. And I'm a Litvak, I told you 1,000 times over, someone doesn't put on tefillin, I'll send my grandchildren punch that animal in the nose. I'm a Kanai, doesn't put on tefillin, a nice vapa, I better not use the word manuval. A nice vapa, pushtak, a trumpenik, you understand? But Chabad, what a difference, but you see, I've quieted down. I have to understand, we all understand where we're coming from, what we're up against. Ribbono shel Olam, people are tinokot shenishbu in the full sense of the word. You go to Atlanta, I came in, they gave me a tour of Atlanta, so there's the big conservative temple, it's like a whole block. And they give me a tour, and they take me into the room where Rabbi, I believe his first name was Harry Epstein, he was the rabbi. This was a nephew of the Levush Mordechai. His father was the elder Torah scholar in Chicago, Rabbi Ephraim Epstein. And the room, remember I told you about it a few years ago, the room is like he left it when he died. No change, nothing. It's like walking into the, I don't know, it was the 50s, the 60s, whatever. The furniture, the books, with awe. And then you look around, what remained? He thought by becoming conservative he could bring, all right, let the men and women sit together, but there'll be Shomer Shabbos and Kashrut, and nothing remains, nothing remains. The grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, very sad. But all right, this is Satma, and this is the Rav, and obviously it had a great influence on me. I remember it like yesterday. Until today, I can tell you by heart. There's some people have a certain, I have a different type of memory. I remember every conversation I ever had since the age of 4 or 5. Every last conversation I can repeat to you word by word. But I apologize. If I would remember what I've learned in Torah, I'd be one of the Gedolei Yisrael. I have learned so much. All right, I can't complain. I heard him, Charlie, you want to vote from the Rav? It's worth 36,000 to the IOU list. The Rav said, just what I'm saying. I mean, Levin, you forget, and forget. But the Rav says, no, Torah is like a mikveh. You go to mikveh, you dry yourself off. You're no longer wet, but the purity remains. You may forget the Torah, but the purity remains. But this I remember. Hilchat Tshuva Perek Gimel Halacha Yud Aleph HaPoresh Min HaTzibur. Okay, so that takes care of that. something from Nachum Lamb before I begin the shiur. Beautiful. I can tell, I don't know which class I mentioned it. Again, I don't know if I mentioned the class. I mentioned also because I'm always speaking. What can I tell you? I'm a Della Kaddish Baruch Hu that people want to hear my voice. I'm only happy when they don't bring me life and death issues. But what can you do? That's part of life too. I can tell stories about Professor Elman all day. I remember one minute after class when he left his gottel in his office. So one of the students gave him his own belt. I'll never forget the image of him standing in front of us saying Shmon Esrei with a rainbow-colored belt strapped tightly over his jacket. So that should be a good memory of Professor Elman. All right, I'm ready to begin. This is the most serious lecture of the year. And I want to give it properly. I want to open your minds, and I want to begin with an introduction. When we get involved with the Holocaust, you have to remember, we're dealing with hindsight. How many years? It's 80 years after 1937, the year I was born. 81 years already. Hindsight, inevitably, is easier than foresight. We have never had a Holocaust before. Never. You read the memoir literature, very intelligent people. I'll cite Rabbi Dr. Zerach Bahaftik. For the younger people here, Rafi, made believe you heard of the name, so the ignorant will pass for the wise. Got it? Zerach Bahaftik, big Mizrahi leader, member of the first Knesset. Every Knesset till the day he died, Sar B'Memshelet Yisrael, religious minister, big Talmud Chacham, gave a shiur once a week in Heichal Shlomo. A Litvisha, big Zionist, has wonderful children today all over Israel, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, etc. So he wrote a memoir, and he said, you know, people knew it was a terrible era. People knew that Jews were being persecuted. But everyone figured, Gam ze ya'avar, we lived through the Crusades. We lived through the Khmelnytsky massacres. In any other persecution, 1,000 were killed, 10,000 were killed, 100,000 were killed. But never was there an attempt to kill every last Jew. And I'll add, in all the other persecutions, you could save your life. Kiss the cross, feign Christianity. With Hitler, nothing mattered. You were one quarter Jewish blood. You could be walking around with a crucifix. You're a Jew. He killed you. We did not know that in the 1930s. Everyone understood it's not a good time for the Jews. The Crusades are coming back. The Khmelnytsky massacres are coming back. The pogroms are coming back. But we'll survive. We'll survive. It took quite a while for the thought to set in that this is different. And the truth of the matter is it never set in until about 1942. That's when the news was really coming out of what Hitler was doing. And as much as the State Department tried to keep it quiet and pleaded with the leaders of Jewry, including some of the most famous Reformed rabbis in America, keep it quiet. But by the end of 42, anyone who had a brain knew what was happening. I remember riding on the subway, it was the 3rd Avenue, well, not the subway anymore, the above ground doesn't exist today. But one of the earliest conversations of my life, I remember saying to my father, this would be at 43, I would say, and saying to my dad, my pop, the Zichron Levracha, how can we sit so quietly when all our brethren, cousins, whatever word I used, I don't think I knew the word brethren yet, but cousins, relations, all the Jews, as we sit here, hundreds of thousands are being killed every day. I remember saying that to my father. I don't remember. His response was, you know, we're doing the best we can. What can we do? But I remember clearly. Now, I want to make something clear. When it comes to saving people, it's a no-win situation. Why? Because you will always have to choose. Imagine we go on a TO, everyone in this room, and we're captioned. And the Hamasnik or the Hezbollahnik or the Iranian guy says, well, we have a famous rabbi here. We're going to do a gesture. He can choose 1 out of 10 to stay alive. You follow me, Dov? No matter who I choose, it's a lose situation because another 9 families are going to be furious at me. Excuse me? Yeah, no, you understand. You'll say, do a goral. It's not an answer. So you did a goral. Why didn't you choose Shimi? Why didn't you choose Rafi? Jacobs, big yichus. What a Jacobs family. You don't know what Harun Jacobs, claim him as your great-grandfather. Follow me, let the world prove he's not your great-grandfather. Big yichus. Shimon, Simon. This is a terrible, terrible reality. There's no right or wrong. And this is why you have the classic example in the state of Israel, the man who did survive, whom I'm about to mention, Kastner, K-A-S-T-N-E-R, the famous Hungarian, the train, Charlie, that saved the Satmaruv. He was one of the 1,500 on the train. Himmler, you know what I'm talking about? Kastner, who worked for the Jewish Agency, they made a deal with Himmler, with Eichmann, give us a train filled with Jews, a safe train that will get to Switzerland somehow, and we'll give you endless cars and money, whatever you need. And it was a deal that was worked out, and as you know, walking near the beach in Tel Aviv a few years later, Kastner was assassinated near the beach, I believe it was. And it was a murder that was solved. The guy went to jail. He was released after a number of years. And it was a question. He was put on trial, Kastner, and he was found. The person who accused him of libel, Malkiel Greenwald, if I recall the name, a Mizrahiite, he went to trial, put Kastner, and you're accusing me of libel? What you did? You chose this one, you didn't choose this one. I'll tell you in a second, one more point. And he was found guilty. Remember how much he was fined? Something like 1 shekel. Follow me? The judge told the world, yes, technically he's guilty, but he's absolutely innocent. He has every right to be mad at Kastner. He was fined 1 penny, put it in your language. I once was fined 10 agarot. It was a whole story with where I got a ticket. I didn't deserve the ticket, but the police don't show up in the trial here. And finally the judge tells me, plead guilty. You don't have to stop, because every time I had to stop teaching that day to go. I was fined the 10 agarot. Then I'm waiting online in the bank to pay the fine. And the guy said, Mazer, Tassapelli at the Sipur, 100 people behind me. 30 minutes, I had to tell him the whole story. There's more to the story, too. When I came back to Mechalan, I told the story to the Israeli girls. They all said, you did fantastic. I told the story to the American girls. Rebbe, we're disappointed in you. You didn't stick to your principles. And think about that. It reflects 2 different ways of thinking. There's another problem too. Chazal, Shas and Paiskim, Gedolei Yisrael, had tremendous insight to the human being. Chazal already said, Adam Karov Eitzel Atzmo. Anyone who criticized Kastner because he took his own family is an absolute boor. There is no one in the world sitting in this room or listening to this shiur, if you can choose 1,500 people to put them on the train, you're going to choose among them your own family. It's part of human existence, human nature. That's the way God made the world. Adam Karev Eitzel Atzmo. Many stories, American rabbis, when they had to bury criminals, Jewish criminals, Their mothers would cry, Manzun, Manzun, my child, my child. Your son's a criminal, an Eisfaf, a Manuva, we'll use the word now. And you're crying? Of course you're crying. It's your son. It's your baby. Haben Yakili Li Ephraim. Yelet Shashuim. Mide Dabru Bozachach Askarena Akena Rachamena Num Hashem. The Rebbe always spoke about it. That we plead to God, don't look at us the way we are to now. Sinners, terrible people, Chilul Shabbos rampant. Imagine a Saba Memshalat Yisrael eating Chazar on Shabbos. Look at us when we were babies, when we were pure, the way a mother holds a little baby in her hands. Zachas Karenu, God remembers us as little children, and therefore He has Rachmim on us. That's what we plead with Him on Rosh Hashanah, right or wrong. One of the psukim we read in the Zichronot. Very powerful pasuk. So you see, when you get involved, when you get involved with selecting and choosing, you cannot win. It's always going to be a difficult area, and you're always going to be open to criticism. And a lot of the criticism, because we're going to touch upon some questions, a lot has been written to criticize the Var Hatzalah. I tell you, it's absolutely unfair. With hindsight, yeah, you can criticize from today to tomorrow, but they were living at the moment with no real idea of the total picture, what would really happen, and it's unfair to be critical. One should be positive in the achievements. And there's another point to this. We all have to give charity. All right? Some people you go to for charity and they'll say, you want me to give to this yeshiva, to the boys serve in the army? If they serve in the army, I'm not giving. That's not a yeshiva. Other people, myself included, I'll only give to a yeshiva where the boys serve in the army. All right? I can only tell you with the Rav, absolutely. I've told the story again. I don't know how many people know the story. But in the 1970s, the Rav, remember I told it to you in class, right or wrong, the Rav won the pras for Chinuch in the Golan, he gets a check, and his children call him, Abba, what should we do with the check? He says, endorse my name and signed it over to Merkaz Yeshivat Bnei Akiva, which was then on Rehov Dubanov, if I recall correctly, in Tel Aviv. But you have a charity. Do you have a right to pick the Kohen? Shimon, you have to give Truma. Can I come and say, I'm a Kohen, give me your Truma, slap your face and rob it from a thief? It's yours, you have the right. And no one can be criticized. If I want to give charity, I'm not going to give to merits. I'm not going to give to the New Israeli Fund. I'm not going to give to something I don't believe in. I have a right to choose. It's my money, I'm giving charity. Fine, good, but I have a right to choose. And this, too, is very important because you'll see that criticism will come up. Well, it's only Yeshivat Mir, it's only the Litvisher, it's only the Frum people. Chabad has plenty of complaints, and now it seems rightfully so that orders were given only for Litvisher, not for Chabadnikim. But again, no one saw the total picture then. We were in a fog. We were functioning in darkness. Okay, now let me begin with the facts. Rav Chaim Moshe plays a very big role. What happened was that when the Germans invaded Poland September 1st, 1939, everyone knows that date. World War II actually begins on that date. The Germans invaded Poland. Poland was filled with yeshiva that had run away. For instance, you take an example, Kletsk. Kletsk was originally in Russia, in Right Russia, was in Slutsk. But after the communists took over, following World War I, they ran away to Poland, and there were tremendous yeshiva. If you don't know what the Slutsk yeshiva is, I'll give you its modern version, Lakewood. Lakewood is the continuity of Slutsk. Mir was in Poland. One Litvishi yeshiva after another. They had to get out of White Russia. They had to get out of the Ukraine. The communists were all over. Communists did not tolerate religion, as you know. And everything is in Poland. And now Poland is being conquered by the Nazis. All the yeshivot, one by one, inevitably and instinctively, underline the word instinctively, ran away to Vilna. Why to Vilna? Reb Chaim Isaac Grishinsky. He was heads and shoulders above anyone else in the generation. The whole Litvisha world looked up to him, turned to him, and they all figured if we have some way of salvation, it's going to be in Vilna. To add to it, right after the Nazis invade, they make a deal with Russia, with the communists, and we wind up that communism will go to here, Nazism will go to here, and in the middle there will be an independent Lithuanian state. Right or wrong? And wow, they thought this is fabulous, we can go to Vilna, Vilnius as it's called in the Lithuanian language, and we're going to have an independent state, and the communists won't bother us, and the Nazis won't bother us. And lo and behold, within a few months, the whole deal fell apart, and Vilna, Lithuania, is conquered by the Russians. So, by the Russians. Yeah, initially it's conquered by the Russians, of course. And now all the yeshivas are there. One side are the Germans fighting the Russians. The Russians, even if you're under Russian domain, they are communists. And La'an, what do we do? What do we do? And everything centered around Reb Chaim Isaac Grishinsky. Remember, these are the last years of his life. He will take ill, stomach cancer, I believe it was. Who knows if the aggravation didn't abide it and abate it and cause it. And he dies August 1940. Now, while all this is happening, Reb Chaim Moser makes a very interesting decision. And here you come back to Parshat Noach. And look at the ark. Every species is represented. Why didn't God decide keep the dinosaurs out of the ark? They can be harmful. I mean, do an example. Pick on some animal that could be harmful. No, God told Noah, from every species, either 7 and 7 or 2 and 2, whether they were Tahara, Tameah, but take from everyone. After the ark, we want, when they go out, to recreate the civilization as it was, the world as it was. For the world to thrive, it needs humans, it needs kangaroos, it needs snakes. There's a whole civilization here, a whole give and take, where we all form part of the majestic creation of the Ribbono Shel Olam. We depend upon each other. Fine, good. So Reb Chaim Moser made the decision, all the yeshivas should remain separate. In other words, every yeshiva had its own tinge, its own, shall we say, configuration, its own color, its own hashkafa, its own way of learning. Keep it separate. Slabodka, Mir, Radin, Telz, Kaidan, Slutz, and he made a second decision, also very intelligent. Don't keep them all together, near each other. When the Jews will be seen as one unit, it only invites more hatred. If we separate them and don't let the Gentiles walk past the street in which 2,000 boys are learning, I have 300 in this shul, a half mile away, I have another 300, so everyone is divided up. Now, this theory, I want to pause for a second. Can anyone tell me who else used this exact theory? Kastner. When Kastner was put on trial, one of the questions that came up, why did you save this one? Why did you save that one? Why did you save the Sakhmurov who hates Israel with a passion? I mean, here's a man who was saved by the Jewish agency, and people would say to him, how can you hate Israel? You were saved by the precursor of the state of Israel, the Jewish agency. And he answered, Nein, the Ribbono Shel Olam saved me, and walked away. He wouldn't speak to them further. But they asked Kastner, and Kastner, what has been labeled in Israel, the Noah Ark theory. He saved Jews from every type of stream and understanding, so that after the Holocaust, the world could be built again with right-wing Orthodox, centrist Orthodox, left-wing Orthodox, neo-log, conservative, Reconstructionism, which didn't exist yet, but in Europe, but the whole concept, reform. He saved every type of ilk, Zionist, non-Zionist. There's truth to it. There's absolutely truth. He did his best. Yeah, there were people he saved, because family, friends, but he tried his best to recreate Noah's Ark. Now, while this is going on, one tremendous problem comes to the forefront: money. As is, since the Depression, the yeshiva in Europe was suffering. And now you're throwing them all into the Vilna area. Money is lacking. The times are terrible. People are running for their lives. No one knows what tomorrow will bring. And the only ones in the world who can help them, save them, American Jewry. Israel is not the center of the Jewish world. Then it's not like today, when we are the center of the Jewish world, and we can send the Minister of Education to Pittsburgh, we can send the head of the Jewish agency to Pittsburgh. At that time, Israel, Palestine is a few hundred thousand poor Jews. Center of the world now, since World War I, if you've heard my lectures, the United States of America and Canada. Now, what existed in America? And I come back to lectures, was it this year, last year? Ezra Taylor. After World War I, the rabbis in America, the Agudas HaRabbanim, organized a relief organization, Kishmo Kenhu, Ezra Taylor, to help the rabbis, to help the Torah Jews, to help the yeshiva boys in Europe and in Palestine. The head of the Ezra Torah was a great tzaddik, a great gaon, the posek of America before Rav Moshe Feinstein. You've all heard the name, Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. You all know his great-grandchildren were killed in a terrorist attack a few years ago. Lo aleinu, family wiped out, children of the famous Henkins who run Nishmat. Children and grandchildren. Lo aleinu, lo aleinu. But I'm going to introduce a sentence that you should never forget, and it explains exactly what's happening. And again, I may be the last one alive that can quote this to you. I heard it from the people involved. The problem with Ezra's Torah was they thought in terms of dimes and nickels. We now needed hundreds of thousands of dollars. Quote, end quote. And that's exactly Rav Finkin was a Yiddayaka who lived on the Lower East Side. You all remember my lectures. He refused to take a raise. He said, I have enough money to live on. He didn't go to Israel to visit. They wanted to send him. No, use this money for poor people, not for me. His concepts were very limited with fundraising. If a shul made an appeal, and I told you, I just heard a joke on a tape, Rabbi Mizrahi, that's the name, right? Rabbi Yosef Mizrahi, very interesting guy. They put him in Cheirim, my friends put him in Cheirim. The truth is, he's a character, par excellence. I'm not happy with all his words, but I enjoy listening to him because he's good sense of humor, and I enjoy his mistakes in English. should stick to Hebrew, but he's an American already. So he tells the story of a poor man comes to the rabbi and he says to the rabbi, I need stuck, I have to marry off a daughter. The rabbi says, you know what, come to shul, we auction off the aliyahs on Shabbos, and whatever we get, I'll give you. The guy comes to shul and they start auctioning off, and a guy says, 36! Another guy says, 72. This guy is so happy, he thinks 36. Finally, the guy says, $1. You follow? That was Ezra's Tyrus thinking. Dimes and nickels. Rav Lezer Silva, who was the key individual in America, the head of the Agudas Rabbanim, the most famous Orthodox rabbi, a man who had international contacts, including with, of course, Rav Chaim Isaac Grushinsky, Rav Lezer said, no, this is not for Vad HaRabbanim, we have to organize a Vad HaTzala. And in late 1939, they organized the Vad HaTzala. The impetus comes from the Agudas HaRabbanim, from Rav Lezer Silva. There's another Rosh Yeshiva who happens to be in America at the time and doesn't go back to Europe. He was stranded there. He was raising funds. The Lumsha Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Yechiel Michal Gordon. Some of you have heard the names Rabbi James Gordon, Rabbi Macy Gordon. They were nephews of the Lumsha Rosh Yeshiva. And he still was an eyewitness to what's going on in Europe. He could comprehend. He was there. He knew all the players. And he agreed with Reb Lezer Silva 100%. We need a Vad HaTzala, a different, vibrant, major organization that can raise millions, not $100 bills. Now, there's a lot of pressure on Reb Lezer. A lot of people from the Agudas HaRabbanim felt it should be a narrow organization. The Agudas HaRabbanim should take charge. There were Gudistim who said, we don't want any Mizrachistim involved here. People were pulling in different directions. And Reb Lezer insisted the Vad HaTzala has to be above politics. It has to contain all Torah Jews who are willing to work, to contribute, to save the Torah civilization of Eastern Europe. And in the initial organization, Reb Lezer was selected as chairman. Rabbis Rosenberg and Leventhal were the honorary chairman. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Gordon was in charge of the executive committee. But in addition, who was invited and became very active? Young Israel, which at that time was the leading Americanized Torah organization. RCA is still in its diapers, Rabbinical Council of America. The OU is minor league compared to Young Israel. And who gets very heavily involved? The leading balabas of Young Israel, Erwin Bunim. Have you heard the name? A fire in his soul. Rafi, did you read that book, Feldheim Publication, by his son Amos, Sichrono Levracha? Read that book. I know his daughter lives within walking distance of here. Chana Orsabel. She is a daughter of Erwin Bunim. It's the last survivors of that generation. She has a sister in New York, married to my chaver, my classmate, Joel Schreiber. That's the son, Amos died already, Zichrona Levracha. Erwin Bunim, just to mention his name, this was a balabas who was from, who did anything and everything that the Rabbanim asked him to do. Another name, OU, RCA, who was the most prominent rabbinic figure of both organizations. He's the only one who has been president of OU and president of RCA, Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein, the maverick rabbi. Shimmy, have you read the biography of Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein by his grandson Aaron Rachel? Make believe you have, so the ignorant pass for the wise. Oh, Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein. Vic, remember the name? West Side Institutional Synagogue began in Harlem. He was the Rabbi Riskin of his generation. 1920s, Sunday morning, he would march through Harlem, followed by hundreds of young Jewish kids going to Sunday school to let the world know there's still Jews around. Harlem, Rabbi Goldstein. He became active. And the little nascent Agudat Yisrael, no, give me the name, legendary figure, first cousin of Rabbi Moshe Scherer, Michael Tress. Have you read the biography, Dov? It's one of the best biographies that Art Scroll has put out on Mike Tress. Total life. All his existence, all his money, only one goal, to save as many Jews as possible. And here, one second, I want to get my notes. Did a lot of research. I didn't depend upon memory or my original scholarship in the Suva era. I have more material today because more has been published, more is available. The archives of the Vat Hatzalah were not available when I worked on my Suva era book. All I had was from Rabbi Suva's archives. I had material, but I didn't have it all. Later, the entire archive was transferred to Yeshiva University, open to the public, and the famous Nazi hunter, Effie Zuroff, my dear friend, the Dr. Ephraim Zuroff, did his doctorate at Hebrew on the Vat Hatzalah. It's beyond my work, because he had more material available. At this point, yeah, you're raising money, but there's one problem. Today, you can get married in Jerusalem and live, they can watch the wedding in the United States. Right or wrong? You can have a Brit, Lo Aleinu, funerals, they broadcast funerals live, while it's going on. At that time, what's going on? No computer, no TV, very limited telephone connections. So Reb Lazer understood right away, we have to send someone to Europe to report back live what's happening, what the real situation is, what we can do, how we can do it. And here Reb Lazer Silva shows his communal genius in the choice he makes who to send. Look, if you send the Rav with the langa bod, a big beard and payas with black clothes, then you come back, he comes back to America, so half the YU, young Israel, OU crowd will turn themselves off. Doesn't represent us. You send someone who's totally out of the Jewish picture, but he's a Jew by birth. He comes back. He's an assimilated guy. What does he know? Reb Lazer picks on someone who is one of my big heroes, Samuel Schmidt. And here let me give you a little bit of the background, who he was, and what happens. At a certain point, I apologize, I'll break down and cry, I can't help it, but it shows what a failure I am, because I could never achieve what Reb Shmuel Schmidt achieved. I'll explain later. Samuel Schmidt, his years 1883-1965. He was born in Kovno, the old country, came to America a teenager. earned an advanced degree from MIT, quite a brilliant fellow, worked as an industrial health inspector. Worked for the city. Had a job like Dr. Zuberstein had, who I quoted last week. But later in life, he wanted to work for the Jewish people. He was not from, but had a lot of Jewish feeling. And in Cincinnati, got very involved in the socialist Zionist movement. It was called Poalitzion. They raised money for medical units in Palestine. And he was a tremendous Zionist. In the 1920s, 1927 to be exact, the year that Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs, he established a weekly Anglo-Jewish newspaper in Cincinnati. That itself tells you something. The man totally, totally involved with the Jewish community. The paper was called Every Friday, and it was published for decades and decades. So here's a man who's Jewish conscious, not religious, but born in Europe, knew what it's about, active in the community, and was close to Rabbi Silva when he came to Cincinnati and turned Cincinnati around. Rabbi Laser suggested that he go. First thing he did, he asked his wife's permission. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, if you came into the Rebbe, Jack came into the Rebbe and he says, Rebbe, I want to be a shaluch to Kenya. And the Rebbe would say to him, before we even talk about it, did you ask your wife's permission? Is she with you? Okay. No. She said yes. And I want to skip ahead. We'll come back now to what he does, but I want to tell you something amazing. In 1965, he was honored, and he was addressing the Jewish National Fund dinner in Cincinnati. They were honoring him for a lifetime of work for the Jewish people, Zionism. 82 years of age, and right when he was towards the end of his speech, he collapsed and died of a heart attack. That's the way this man died, 1965. I don't think he could have picked a better scenario for his final moments. While speaking, JNF, Jewish Zionism, his whole life. And now I go parentheses. Charlie, what years did you grace the halls of Yeshiva University in Washington Heights? Give me the years. 1962, June. Do you remember what happened at Yeshiva University? I hope I'm not the last one to tell this story. You won't believe your ears. But Mark, check it out. As Casey Stengel used to say, it's in the record book. Every 3 years, YU would hold a big celebration, a Chag HaSmicha, where, I remember, I had to come with a fancy dress. Today they don't require it, but in those days we were robots. Dov, remember your Chag HaSmicha? But in my time, every year they had a little party. 1961, Rakepin has twice published the picture of his smicha class, and I identify everyone in the picture. Beautiful. 1962, they held a Chag HaSmicha, not a little private affair, a bigger one, in the Beis Medrash, the Harry Fishel Study Hall. And who was speaking? Reb Shmuel Leib Zah, the Rashlaz, Dean Zah. Charlie, do you remember him? living figure, finished his speech, walked back to his seat up front, sat down and keeled over and died in the Beis Medrash. So here you have two examples of two men, 3 years apart. What a story. But let me come back to Mr. Samuel Schmidt, Dr. Schmidt. All right? 1940. Could you imagine? This man lives in Cincinnati, travels to Eastern Europe, travels to Vilna, comes in with an American passport, arrives in Vilna. He leaves sales on February 8th, 1940, 19 days later, arrives in Vilna. And he goes to see Reb Chaim Isaac. And this is Reb Shmuel's description of what happened. I told Rabbi Grushinsky of my mission. He asked that I tell him about myself. I broke down like a Jew on Yom Kippur and told him about my entire life and the causes I previously espoused. When I finished, Reb Chaim Isaac gently placed his hand on my shoulder. He asked whether I would permit him to address me as Reb Shmuel in the traditional fashion. I answered, "I'm not worthy of such an honor." Reb Chaim Isaac, however, insisted that I am. He claimed that I proved myself by leaving the security of the United States and journeying to a war zone to aid my brethren. At that moment, I became another person. I became Reb Shmuel. And you should know that he became a total Shomer Torah and Mitzvot. And I've met descendants of his great-grandchildren, Shomrei Torah and Mitzvot. And that's why I say Rakefet is a failure, because people see me and they remain the same Mechalalei Shabbos. Terrible, terrible. You see a Jew, a real Jew, that's an impact. Draw your own conclusions. But what a beautiful, beautiful story. He not only became a Jew, he was overwhelmed by what he saw. And I'll quote to you from some of his writings in Every Friday. Excuse me. The heroism, I'm quoting from the April 5th, 1940 issue of Every Friday, the heroism of the yeshiva bachurim in fleeing to Vilna to pursue their ideals cannot be overestimated. In general, the way the yeshivat managed to settle here is nothing short of a miracle. The yeshivas themselves are an institution remaining untouched, unblemished, entirely immune to the ravishes of time. There are some 2,400 refugee yeshiva men studying with devotion and fervor in the various synagogues of towns throughout Lithuania, having but recently escaped from such hell, is a strong manifestation that we are a people of destiny. It's beautiful. You have to understand, the whole world was in turmoil. Here are the Nazis, here are the communists. And these kids are sitting and learning. A later issue of Every Friday. A Jew with the ordinary 5 senses cannot hardly appreciate the Jewish cultural reservoir in such yeshiva. You must possess the true, basic, specifically Jewish sense to be able to comprehend the dynamic cultural current that is being generated and stored for future generations in these yeshivas. It is this very current which is the driving power in all of us who are working for a positive Jewish life, even though some of us may be removed far, far from the source where this current is being generated. And I want to tell you, true words were never spoken. Where would we be today without the Shanghai survivors who came to America, came to Israel, the Sheret HaPleita rejuvenated. Take a look what we have today. Reb Heschel Schechter just arrived this morning. I saw they were leading him into the Sfadik Minyan, and he doesn't have tefillin on. So I gather he must have davened at the airport Shachrit, and he didn't hear Kriyas HaTorah. He may have davened on the plane Shachrit. I did that once. Because I saw till I'll get to Yerushalayim, we have this man tefillah, and they took him into Yekrit HaTorah. It's Monday today. So when I saw Reb Heschel, does that bring back memories? He was my brother's chavruta, 7, 8 years. He's 2 years younger than I am. I was at Ben Bayit in his house. How many from kids were there in the Bronx? Well, it's mind-boggling. And look what came out of the Bronx, out of Manhattan, out of Washington Heights, out of Atlanta, Georgia. Take a look what you have here. Let's be positive. Leave the politics out of it. I admit it's disturbing to hear the Degel HaTorah boo the Vishnitz Rebbe. I still can't get it out of my mind. But let's be positive. And take a look in Pittsburgh, how in Hebrew, I saw it yesterday on the computer, Yitgadel v'yitgadesh shemei rabban, they tell me it's the leading daily newspaper in Pittsburgh. And in New York, on the news, I think it was ABC, they showed the news, they ended off with the funeral and everything, and they had the chazan from Fifth Avenue, the synagogue, they showed the paper, and they had the chazan saying Kaddish on the TV. It's a different world. Baruch Hashem. He hit the nail on the head. In a later issue, all this that I'm quoting now is from the Sylvia, and in a minute I'll quote from Dr. Zurov's work. You know, by the way, Efri Zurov, who's his grandfather? No? Who did we just speak about? Dying in the Beis Medrash. Reb Shmuel Leib Zar, Efri Zurov's grandfather. His mother, Zichrona Levracha, was the daughter of Reb Shmuel Leib Zar. She was married to Rabbi Abe Zurov. And Efri Zurov is a grandson. Wow. Something else. Here, he not only goes to the various yeshiva, but he meets the various personalities. And here, this man from Cincinnati, MIT graduate, all right, he knew Reb Lezer Silva, he saw Gedolei Yisrael. He now meets one of the younger Rosh Yeshiva at the time, the Kletzke Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Aaron Cutler. And here's his description. I just returned to Kovna from Yanovil, where the Kletzke Yeshiva is now located. Reb Aaron Cutler is the Rosh Yeshiva there. He is indeed a most interesting person and considered the greatest Talmudic master of his own age. He is about 48 years old, with blue and smiling eyes, of small stature, powerful determination, and penetrating vision. I have to say, I don't believe there was a better description of Reb Aaron. That's exactly Reb Aaron. Small of stature, penetrating eyes, determination, perception. And now I'll tell you, just jumping ahead, this will explain something else to you. When the Var Hatzalah went to work and tried to get visas to enter America of the Europäische Rosh Yeshiva, they got one visa. And in Vilna, they decided to send Reb Aaron Cutler. And you got to ask yourself a question. Why Reb Aaron? They were more famous Rosh Yeshiva. They were Rosh Yeshiva in their 60s, 70s. Authors of Sfarim. Why Reb Aaron? And the answer is twofold. One, no one had more penetrating desires, vision. Nothing could budge him. Nothing could stop him. Number two, he was 48 years of age, younger. And this was a big factor in the decision to send Reb Aaron to America, because older people, and you'll all understand that as you grow older, you don't have the same energy, the same strength. But someone 48 years of age, he's not yet 55, he's not yet 60, he's a dynamo, can turn mountains. And that's why they chose Reb Aaron Cutler. But this was a description of Reb Aaron. I want to quote from Effi Zurab's book now. I'm quoting to you from the response of Orthodox Jewry in the United States to the Holocaust. This is his doctorate. And he quotes many of the same things that I quote in my work on the Suva era. But here, during his visit to Kovna, Schmidt also visited two of the largest refugee Polish yeshiva, Mir, which was located in Kaidan, and Kletsk, which had moved to Yanowa. He was extremely impressed by the diligence of the students. In both, he wrote to his wife, "I found a remarkable devotion for the study of Talmud. I could find no signs that either the spirit or intensity of devotion had been impaired by the terrible experiences which they had to live through in the recent months. The Rosh Yeshiva whom Dr. Schmidt met in Kaidan in Geneva also made a strong impression upon him." And then you have the description of Reb Aaron Cutler that I just quoted to you, but he met someone else there, Rabbi Eliezer Shach, whom he described in a letter to his wife as follows, quote, "In appearance, a typical bearded Japanese, or at any rate, Mongolian." Did you know Rav Shach? Did you ever meet Rav Shach? I met him more than once. Look at a picture of him, a younger man, his face. He looks Mongolian. It's unbelievable. This description is right on. A charming smile which refuses to leave his countenance with penetrating jet black eyes. "He left an indelible impression upon me, and I lost no opportunity to keep him in my view all the time that I was in the yeshiva." Charlie, could you believe what you just read? 1940. Who heard of Rav Shach? Who knew of Rav Shach? And here, Rev Shmuel Schmidt predicts, and correctly so, this man will be one of the Gedolei Yisrael. The two people he writes about, Reb Aaron Cutler and Reb Eliezer, as we know him afterwards, Menachem Man Shach. Ah, what a story. What a story. He comes back to America, the end of May, addresses the Vat Hatzalah. Reb Lezer Suva telegraphs Reb Chaim Moser that Dr. Schmidt has returned, and he presents to Reb Shmuel Schmidt a letter that had already arrived before his return, where Reb Chaim Moser thanks him, and the letter closes on a mundane note: "Please express my thanks to your distinguished wife for agreeing to your journey under such dangerous circumstances." All right, with the return of Reb Lezer Shach, the description, the yeshiva, the Var Hatzala begins work full time. Fundraising, the Mir Yeshiva, Shanghai will come to it, if not today, next week. But I want to call your attention to another factor at this time. By 1940, the dark clouds are getting more ominous. And you can't hide from the reality. And the Var Hatzala is getting endless requests to save people. Rabbanim, yeshiva students, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam, Shehakol Nehiyeh B'Dvaro. The tragedy is there is no country open to the Jews coming in. Palestine, you all know the white paper. When you go to England, don't be so happy with the English history and their relationship with the Jews. America, almost equally bad. You need a non-quota immigrant visa. Study American history, you'll find out what happened in 1921, the law that was passed, that went into action, that became applicable in 1922. Every country in the world gets a quota coming to America. The East European quota is filled very quickly for the next 30, 40 years. You can't let an East European in. So you needed a non-quota immigrant visa. What does that mean? That an institution in America requests you that you have something to give them that they can't get in America. Meaning, Dov Zakheim is a student in Mir. We need more students who are learned in the Talmud. Please grant them a non-quota immigrant visa so we can bring them to Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Hanan. Got it? Yomo Gachman is a rabbi in a European shtetl, and he has expertise in the Rambam, and there's a shul in Kalamazoo, Michigan, that needs a rabbi who knows Maimonides. Non-quota immigrant visa. That's how the Rev got to America. Hebrew Theological College, Chicago, requested him to be the Rosh Yeshiva. There's no one in America who equals him. Got an non-quota immigrant visa. The pressures on the Var Hatzala are death-making. You're getting letters. Life and death is in your hands. So what would they do? They would turn to the yeshivat to issue these visas. The most important yeshiva at the time was Yeshiva Reb Yitzchok Hanan. They were the ones that had the ability, the contact, the secretaries, the know-how, the political connections. Invite rabbis. Invite students. Charlie Hexter is sitting here, and he can give Eidut Nemana that Rabbi Joseph Breuer's life was saved by Yeshiva University. They were able to issue the visa. We need him, he's a teacher, he's an expert in Bible, a well-known German rabbi, got the visa out. But the sad part is that not always did you succeed. You had to go through the State Department. There was a whole process. They're dealing with thousands of requests. And here I found sad correspondence between the Var Hatzala, we come back to Dean Zar again, where you can understand what's happening. In June 30th, 1940, Reb Shmuel Zar answered Silva, we've already sent three letters to the American Council regarding this pupil. We have no idea what is really happening there. As far as we are concerned, we have fully exhausted all the channels open to us. Reb Lezer Silva continued to press the yeshiva. On July 11th, Tsar writes, I am once again writing to you regarding the student you wish to bring to America. I don't know what more I can do. I have already told you many times that we sent numerous letters to the consul. We have informed them that we are accepting the student. The truth is that the yeshiva can do no more. It is now entirely up to the council. If they choose not to accept our letters, then there is no way to overcome the supposition. And you see, this was the reality. Someone famous, you could get congressmen involved, senators involved. Someone roll of the mill, just another student, another rabbi. At times you succeeded, and at times you struck out, and life and death was involved. And here I'll state a personal note. It is my understanding from all the research I have done, this is what killed my own relative, the famous person to build Torah in America, the very first one, Rabbi Dr. Bernard Revel. When you read the story of Revel's life, the depression already created heart trouble. But the Makkah B'Potash, the final death bell, was this pressure, saving people, people bothering him, people pleading with him, the obligation he felt, and the frustration when you could do nothing, you couldn't open up a channel, you couldn't save. And this was the 1940s. It reached the zenith that year. Into 1941, there was still a chance to get people out alive. And how do you do it if the governments are not willing to take them in? All right, their famous names, Rabbi Yosef Breuer is one example. There were some very famous German professors in various fields who later teach at Yeshiva University. Reb Mendel Zaks, the Chofetz Chaim's son-in-law, they were able to get him out in 41. They're famous people, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, they're already their miracle stories of how he got out in 1940, the sixth Rebbe, with the, we've all spoken about it. It seems that from the Wehrmacht, from the SS, one of the leading officers had Jewish blood in him. And he went out of his way to help get the Lubavitcher Rebbe out of Warsaw and get him to the boat and get him to be able to sail for the United States. But these were moments of such tension, of such pressure. Again, you're pleading for your relative's life, you're pleading for a rabbi's life, you're pleading for a student who's a Talmud Chacham, who can be a Gaon, and you're up against forces that not only can't you control, but it's very arbitrary, when yes and when no. And all these words I just stated, when you read the memoir literature, you see it come to life before your eyes. And then I mention in parentheses a very sad story that I discuss in the Silver Era. And if you go online, you'll see the letter. There were people who could have been saved. And the Hashkafa against modernity intervened. And I'm not just talking the Satmaruv, the Belzerov, all of you know that the vast part of the Hasidic world, if they went to their Rebbe, should we go to America? The answer was no, remain here. In America you'll be influenced, who knows what'll be with your children, who knows what'll be with your grandchildren, here you can still remain a Jew. And even the Chafetz Chaim at the end of Nidchei Yisrael, the volume he wrote for Jews that are left Eastern Europe, at the end of the volume I quoted it in the Silver, I translated it into English, but you're all familiar with it, where he writes, you want my real advice? Come back home. It's only here in Poland, in White Russia, in the Ukraine, that your children will remain Jewish. Come back home. And then there's one sad example which leaves you thinking. A student who got the request, and it was going through, to come to Yeshiva Shevitz Kolchanan, what you call today Yeshiva University, and he asked Rebbe Elchanan Wasserman, should he go? And Rabbi Chanan writes to him, the letter is available in Rabbi Chanan's handwriting, and Rabbi Chanan's stationery. God forbid to go to Yeshiva University. You go off the path. Better to try to get a visa through Mesifta Torah V'das. There you will remain a proper Torah Jew. So you see, it works a double-edged sword. And this period, the stories are legendary. You have the story with Torah V'das, with Rabbi Gedalia Shoah, a story that I already knew in the 50s. His own brother-in-law told it to me, or maybe 61 when he told it to me, and I never publicized it. In the Israeli politics, with the split of Degel HaTorah and Agudat Yisrael, it was publicized here by Agudat Yisrael. The letter was made public, a letter which I saw a copy of so many decades ago. And there's another story from this period. Reb Gedalia Shoah, American-born. They say about Reb Gedalia Shoah, he was the first American Adam Gadol. I'm not here to judge. I didn't know him that well personally. But he was a great Talmud Chacham, Rosh Hashiva, Torah V'das. And he goes to Europe to learn, and he winds up in Kletsk, and Baron Cutler loves him. And in 1938 or 39, right at the end, that has to be the summer of 39, I would imagine, his father orders him back home. The American consul tells him to go back home. He already, I believe he was married, and he gives up his apartment, and he sells his furniture, and he's heading for the boat, and Reb Aaron sends him a letter pleading with him, come back, there'll be no war, nothing will happen. I'll rent for you another apartment. I'll get you new furniture. We need you in the yeshiva. Now imagine what would have happened to Reb Gedalia Shoah had he listened to the letter from his Rebbe Muvhak, Reb Baron Cutler. And you have stories like this, black and white, white and black. Sometimes a small little decision, a flip of the coin, meant the difference of life and death. Okay, so this was a very, very difficult period, but the Var Hatzalah begins to act, it begins to raise money, it starts sending tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars, feeding the refugee students, helping Reb Chaim Eiser. Reb Chaim Eiser is still alive, and in the greater Vilna area, all these different yeshivot are thriving. And this is the picture that we leave you with. 1940, Dr. Schmidt back in America, yeshiva students numbering on to close to 3,000 in the greater Vilna area, and dark clouds gathering on all sides. Very shortly, Russia and Germany will break up, go to war with each other. Independent Lithuania ends, and we come into, probably we can call it, the greatest moment of the Var Hatzalah. Now, those who criticize the Var Hatzalah, saying, well, they only dealt with from Jews. You have to understand, at this point in time, no one knew what was going to happen. They were concerned with saving the yeshiva. Adam Korev Eitzel Atzmo. These were all yeshiva graduates, either from Europe or American, the American element. But their affinity, their feeling, their emotion was with the yeshiva. If we lose the yeshiva, we lose Torah. There's no tomorrow. There's no Torah Shabbat Peh. There's no continuity. There's no Gatlutin Torah. What will be with us? And you cannot criticize them. Later, when it becomes clear that Hitler is out to kill every Jew, man, woman, and child, the Var Hatzalah's activities greatly expand, and they try to save every Jew, Bahashehu Sham. But by that time already, it's almost impossible to get anyone out of Europe. So I want to reiterate today's shiur. We began the Var Hatzalah, and I hope I did justice. We covered the late 30s. Most of all, you got to give credit to Rabbi Silva. it's not as rastaira, the thinking is different, the demands are different, the money has to be on a different level. You have to give credit to him that he rises above narrow aguda politics or narrow aguda tarabbanim politics, aguda Yisrael politics. The Vad Hatzalah is a mechanism for all Jews. And all streams, strands, branches of the Torah world, there is unity in the face of tragedy. Dr. Shmuel Schmidt is a story, one of its kind, that is worthy of a movie. I hope in Israel people are listening. We now have religious people who have gone to the religious schools, or even to the general school for making movies, and they should take it further. A movie on one individual, Dr. Shmuel Schmidt, his meeting with Rav Chaim Meiser. As I tell you, when I relive it, I feel how inadequate I am. Okay. Now, one second, we'll pick up exactly where we left off next week. And next Sunday we'll finish out davening b'chol lashon. We do the tshuva of the Chatam Sofer, which is epic-making, that tshuva. There's a lot to talk about. I alluded to it yesterday, my Rebbe's comments, the Rebbe's comments. It's an interesting topic. Hindsight, foresight, where do we go from here? From there we go into computers, and I'll show you an interesting tshuva and give you some interesting stories that continue this topic, computers in the service of Torah. And I'll tell you about my conversation with a sofer, halacha l'ma'asa. Now, the freebies. I offered this yesterday, I know it's interested. These are all the sources for inviting someone to your house Friday night if you know they're going to drive. And there's a whole article on giving someone a cup of water to drink if you know they're not going to make a bracha. This is halacha l'maisa when you're in the Israeli army. Let's say you have kitchen duty and you're serving the soldiers. Some will make a bracha, some won't. What do? These are the sources. I thank Rabbi Grunstein. Pass this back to Charlie. This is the article I want you to look at. And let me know if there's any correction. Now, a lot has happened with President Trump. Here are two articles about Trump visiting Pittsburgh and the reaction. I think the headline sums it up. Tree of Life, Rabbi Myers says he saw a warm and personal side to Trump that surprised him. Whoever this Rabbi Myers with, I wish I would know more. If there's anyone from Pittsburgh, try to find out what kind of shul it is. What were the three different minyanim in the building? To look at Rabbi Myers, he looks like an absolute 100% Orthodox rabbi, black hat, beard, all that goes with your concept. It's not like Kefet. You'd say right away, oh, that's a conservative bum, but it's interesting. I'd love to know. New York Times, among Israel's ultra-Orthodox, it's the year of the woman. And boy, is this true. Beit Shemesh, Lisa Bloch, Dr. Bloch, elected, unbelievable. Haifa, the elect the lady, Degel HaTorah, damn boy, the Hasidim are going crazy, Degel HaTorah, dancing around the lady. Here is a very interesting document. If anyone's interested in documents, it's an invitation to my friend. He was chairman of the board of Bernard Revel, and he's a member of the board of trustees, Mr. and Mrs. Irwin Shapiro, a 5-cent stamp from Moshe Stuff. I know who that was. The Hebrew, Yiddish and English. The officers and trustees of the Chevra Shas HaKlalit of New York, and cordially invite you to attend the Siyum dinner of Masechet Brachot with the participation of our revered Rabbi Dr. Joseph B. Soloveitchik, to be held on Tuesday, March 12, 1963 at 6:30 p.m., Hotel Brewster, 21 West 86th Street, New York City. Subscription $25 per person, no solicitation of funds. Kindly respond immediately. Jack, if we only had a time machine to go back in time, I could have, okay, that's the Rav. Okay. Here's from Mitavli Eliyahu, Rav Dessler, right? You know who all I'm talking about. So a Talmud from London, Bram White, sent me a copy of what he writes about, and believe it or not, I'm happy to say, Labriyot, my own thinking is exactly like the Mikhtab Mialeo. When I spoke about intellectual dishonesty, it's something very bad in you, because it's not only once, it's the whole personality. Once the first crooked argument is lodged in his brain, all that comes after it, the entire structure of his views and opinions will be distorted accordingly. His blindness will continue to intensify until he dies in the same condition. And there's more here, but hit the nail on the head. Here is a whole article on when you are involved in difficult Balei Tshuva questions, what do you do? And it seems a whole book has come out by Rav Avram Wasserman, Re'acha Kamocha, where he deals with all these questions, kashrut, embarrassing someone, and what do you do when someone stops you and asks directions on Shabbos? The question I have raised 1,000 times over with the machloket between the Rav and Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. If anyone sees the sefer, let me know where it's available. Avraham Wasserman, and it's Re'acha Kamocha, but it doesn't tell you anywhere here where you can pick the sefer up, and it doesn't tell you what he paskins when someone stops you halacha l'maisa on Shabbos. It doesn't give you the psak here. I was looking for it. This is Mike Pence, a very embarrassing situation. He has a rabbi speak in a memorial, and it turns out this rabbi is a Jesus rabbi, unbelievable, and embarrassing for the vice president. This is an interesting article from the New York Times on the young evangelicals who speak out, and you can see a young generation, it's also rebelling, which is not good for us. They don't understand their parents' devotion to the state of Israel, the Bible, etc. Here is an article, very fascinating. Yomo, wake up, a Jew born in Russia who comes to America, and he doesn't know what to do with his life. He becomes a chassid, or was a chassid already from Russia, and the Rebbe tells him, you're from Russia, you have to work with the Russian emigres arriving in New York. Today he's the head of the Shluchim, the Chabad outreach to Russians in Los Angeles. Here's the article I referred to. I forgot that you can take it if you want. Very fascinating. A printout from the Warsaw Daily newspaper from Bechvez 1925, and about Rav Moshe Soloveitchik dealing with machine matzahs. A gesprech mit hagoyin Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and Rav Moshe Soloveitchik ate machine matzahs. Anyone who has a key for Chabad, here is Ayelet Shaked, the Minister of Justice at the Rebbe's monument in Brooklyn, and she's meeting with the Chabadnikim. Many fascinating pictures, and Chabad got some feedback. Why are only men surrounding her? You have enough Chabad women who can meet with her in dignity. And boy, does my wife agree, because when we were at a Chabad affair, we couldn't get over one lady, so sophisticated, right with it, the dress, the shaitel, the knowledge, the English, enough ladies. There is still much evil in America. Growing anti-Semitism stuns American Jews. And that's what we spoke about yesterday, Word Web Beryl Vine. And finally, for anyone who still has baseball blood in him, a beautiful eulogy for Willie McCovey, the Hall of Fame slugger with the San Francisco Giants. And he's It meant a lot to me because I saw the AT&T Park right before it opened. The new park they built, it's right on the water, and I couldn't believe it. Outside, they're in, canoes, rowboats, waiting for a home run to be hit over the fence. They're going to catch it, and it's called McCovey Cove. It's crowded on game days with boaters competing to fetch home runs splashing down. Wow. My dear students, until we meet again in health and happiness, and what you can see, you can take a boy out of the Bronx, but you can't take the baseball that he picked up in the Bronx out of the boy. Until we meet again in health and happiness, das vidanya, and I want to thank Shimi and Rafi for honoring us with their presence. Gentlemen, you're at the age where your minds are starting to open. I want you to be gedolei gedolei Yisrael. That's what we need more than anything today, you understand? With the ability to teach and pass it on and to light up not hundreds of souls, but thousands of souls. Devar Hashem zu halacha. Okay. That's the idea. Okay. Anyhow,